right, let's get started. Thanks for coming back from lunch. Our next talk, Eugene Jerniak, will tell us about parsing.
Okay. So I'm going to change gears here for this conference because ultimately I'm not interested in clustering documents or things like that, except insofar as they tell me something about the meaning of the document. And so my primary interest is in meaning, and typically the basic unit of meaning is sort of like the sentence, roughly speaking. And so I'd like to be able to create a program that you give me a sentence and I output the meaning of that sentence, right? Of course, needless to say, I don't have the foggiest idea of how to do that. So I'm going to tackle a slightly simpler problem. In particular, rather than taking a sentence and output its meaning, I'm going to take a sentence and output its syntactic parse. And I'll be telling you what that is and why I care about it in just a second. So the work I'm going to be describing is joint work with Mark Johnson, who's my closest collaborator, whose office is one building away from mine, and David McCloskey, who's a graduate student in computer science. And roughly speaking, the organization of the talk is we're going to start with very ancient results, starting from 1990 to about 2004. Then we're going to talk about merely old results, i.e. last year. And then I'll be talking about some new stuff. So what is parsing? Parsing, in my lexicon, or syntactic parsing, is the process of going from a sentence like Alice ate yellow squash to a phrase structure, as it's called, okay? And so here we've got S, which stands for sentence. And by the way, very often I make assumptions about what people know and don't know, and if it doesn't fit you, just obviously ask questions.
What's squash?
Did I misspell squash? Oh, what's squash?
What is it? Yeah.
It's a vegetable.
Oh. You know pumpkin?
Squash is, you know,
it looks for the meaning.
Yeah, it's like, it's zucchini is a kind of squash. You know what zucchini is?
Thanks, I didn't have it.
So we break the sentence into a noun phrase and a verb phrase. The noun phrase is Alice. The verb phrase consists of a verb and another noun phrase. The verb is ate. The noun phrase consists of an adjective and a noun, yellow and squash. Okay? Now, when I was in grammar school, we used to do something called diagramming sentences. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of diagramming sentences writ large. That's what we're going to be doing. Now, the next question is, why do we want to bother doing this? Okay? The answer is, it gives us a first rough pass at meaning. Very rough. So consider the sentence, in the hotel, fake property was sold to tourists. And I want to ask you a few very simple questions. Okay? What does fake modify? Well, just based on proximity, it might modify hotel. And in particular, if this were French, the adjectives typically come after the noun, so you might think, or it might modify property. Of course, we all know that in English this modifies property. But of course, the computer doesn't know this. And if you can't get something like this right, you have no chance of getting the quote meaning right. And if you do get something like this right, at least you have the basic building blocks of how the meaning of the whole is built up out of the meaning of the parts. Okay, so that's the basic assumption here, and that's what all linguistics is essentially based on, that the meaning of the whole is built up recursively, more or less, of the meaning of the parts. So a fake property is something that's both fake and property. Okay. Another question. What does in the hotel modify? What's in the hotel? Well, it might be the property. That's the thing that's actually closest to it. Or it might be sold. It might tell you where the selling is taking place. Well, again, we all know the answer to that. It's where the selling is taking place. And we know it because of a fact about English grammar. Namely, if you take a prepositional phrase, we could have said, fake property was sold to tourists in the hotel. That would be the sort of more normal organization of the sentence. If you take a prepositional phrase that normally goes at the end and moves it to the beginning, it has to modify the main verb. You can't modify noun phrases underneath it. We all just intrinsically know this, but unless you intrinsically know this, you don't have a chance of guessing that, just based on the linear order. So that's what parsing does for you. It tells you what the basic constituents of the sentence are and how they build up to make the whole. And that's why we care about it. Now, why is it hard? It's hard because of ambiguity. So here's a very simple example. The same words on the left, salesman sold the dog biscuits, has one noun phrase, the dog biscuits. On the right, we give a different syntactic analysis. Salesman sold the dog biscuits. Okay? Again, if you don't know the syntactic parse, you can't get the correct meaning. Okay? And in this particular case, the syntax very closely corresponds to the two dominant meanings of this sentence. There are others, by the way. If you give this to my parser, it will also find a parse of lower probability that says salesman sold, and then you'll see a noun phrase, and then two noun phrases underneath it. One is dog and one is biscuits, and you say, well, what could that possibly mean? And the answer is that might mean that the dog's name was Biscuits. Okay? So the point is that even this very trivial sentence can have, and by the way, my parser will find another 50,000 possible parsers for this thing. I mean, it's very creative. And but they will each have, be wilder and wilder, and very quickly you won't be able to assign any reasonable meaning, but it finds them. Okay? So given the problem of ambiguity, what that means is given any one sentence, we're going to find zillions of possible parses. Okay? What do we do about that? Well, the answer is we try to assign a probability distribution to those parses. We want to know what's the probability of the parse given the sentence, and then takes the most probable. And how do you do that? Well, one way, very common way, is what is called a probabilistic context-free grammar, or PCFG. And what it does is it associates with each context-free rule a probability, and those probabilities have to have the property that, and by the way, this of course is a very trivial fragment, very small, microscopic fragment of a real grammar. This is just enough to handle this one example and no other. And the point is that all the probabilities for a particular left-hand side have to sum to one. And so the interpretation in this particular case is, for example, that the problem of a noun expanding into salespeople is 0.3. This, of course, is ridiculous for all of English. The probability of a noun expanding to salespeople is probably more like 10 to the minus 4, say. But, in this particular case, that's what I assigned it. It may sum to 1. So that's a probabilistic context-free grammar. So this is the game we're going to be playing. What I want to do is I want to take something called the tree bank, which I'll be talking about in a little bit. I'm going to break it up into a training portion and a testing portion. And I'm going to take the training portion, feed it into a, quote, learner. All this learner is going to do is estimate the parameters of my probabilistic context-free grammar, and that turns out to be trivial. Just use a maximum likelihood estimator, and that's the right thing to do in this particular trivial case. Feed that into the parser. Feed those statistics into a parser. I then take a testing portion, which is separate from my training portion, feed that into the parser, get out parses, and then I test how well my parser did by comparing the, quote, correct parse from my annotated tree bank against what my parser returned. So that's the basic paradigm. The particular tree bank, as I call it, or as we all call it in this field, is the so-called Penn Wall Street Journal tree bank. It's about 1 million words. Average sentence length is 23 words in punctuation. Okay? That is the first sentence of the corpus. As you see, these are non-trivial sentences. We're not talking about nice little made-up examples. This is English in all its deviousness. I mean, I didn't make this one up. This was just, this happens to be the very first sentence. Although I will agree, for a sentence of that length, it's slightly more devious than most. The point is that poor graduate students at Penn were given money in exchange for sitting down and taking 1 million words of this stuff and producing complete parse trees for it.
They weren't grad students, just for the record.
They weren't?
I was a grad student at Penn at that time. I was not doing this. There were art history students.
I thought they were linguistic students.
There were a couple of linguistic students. Ann Teller was running the thing.
Yeah.
And she may have done some annotation, but most of the annotators were trained specifically to do this, and they ended up knowing a ferocious amount about English. I would go and I'd ask them, is such and such possible in English? And expecting the answer to be no, you can't do this. And they said, oh yes, there are three circumstances.
So, but they were students, right?
No, I think not all of them were students.
Well, where do you get people to do this?
Did they go on to work for the Wall Street Journal later?
I don't believe that you've got people off the street to do this.
Well, that's not true, because the first tree bank is in Lancaster, and when we ran the tree bank, it was done by housewife.
Really?
Yes, and was run by a woman who did not have a high school diploma, actually.
I take it all back.
And now she's teaching linguistics.
Okay.
So is it possible there is some error in the part?
Oh, yes. Lots of errors. In fact, you'll find identical sentences in identical contexts with three different parts.
So how would they instruct you to disseminate in the case like...
You get them wrong. Yeah, don't worry about it. This is all statistics, right? on average, you get it right. The mistakes, who cares? We'll talk about that a little at the end, okay? Because the question is, what's the maximum level of human performance on this task? And believe it or not, we're getting close. That's the take-home lesson. The strides have been incredible. So how do we learn from this tree bank? Well, so here we've got a tree bank form of that sentence. Salespeople sold the dog biscuits. Notice the punctuation's there, everything's there. And what we do is we pull out what are called the local trees. So that's a local tree. S goes to noun phrase, verb phase, period. And so we pull that out, create this little piece of notation. So that's one of our context-free grammar rules. And we say that has counted one now. And we go down and we now find that local tree, and so that creates verb phrase goes to verb noun phrase, and that has a count of one. And we go through the whole training portion and do this, and we count them all up, and then we've got counts for every left-hand side. We take the count of this divided by the count of all VPs, and that gives us the probability, the maximum likelihood probability of this particular rule. Great. Once you've got that, what we now want to do is we want to find the argmax pi, where pi is the parse of the sentence S, such that it maximizes the probability of the parse given the sentence. That's what we're trying to find, okay? And that is equal to argmax pi of the probability of pi and the sentence. You can get that just by saying that the left-hand side is that divided by the probability of the sentence, but the sentence doesn't change, so it can be removed. And that, in turn, is just equal to argmax pi, because the parse includes the words at the bottom, so that gives you the sentence. So all you have to do is find that. And for probabilistic context-free grammars, it's very easy to do that. Namely, because you're making all these gross independence assumptions, all you do is multiply the probability of every rule, of the rule that expands every constituent in the tree. Just multiply them all together, and that gives you your parse. And then you can use dynamic programming to do this to find the maximum. You know, a nice, efficient algorithm for doing it. Okay, how well do you do? Well, let's define our metrics for measuring how well we do. We're going to, first of all, in what I present, I'm not going to tell you the percentage of time we get the entire sentence correct, because the percentage of time we actually get the entire sentence correct is still very low. In fact, it's low for people. Okay, it's just too hard, because you've got so many interdependent stuff, and basically any sentence, to a first approximation with my parser these days, any sentence less than maybe 16 words, you'll get it all correct, and if it's got more than 16 words, there'll be progressively more errors in it. Okay? So really all you're measuring is how many short sentences there are in your corpus, where short is 16 or so. Still not toy sentences, but shorter than that messy sentence I showed you at the beginning. Instead, what I'm going to be telling you about, we're going to count how many constituents we got right, where a constituent formally is a label like noun phrase, verb phrase, a start point, and an end point. So that's the definition of a constituent. And you can see, roughly speaking, if I give you these, you can build up the tree. There are a few cases of ambiguity in the case of unary productions, but don't worry about that. If you can get all of those right, you're in very good shape. But of course, you can't get all of those right, but maybe we can get most of them right, or almost all of them right. Okay, so that's the formal definition of a constituent. And we say we got one right if what we produced in terms of these three, in terms of this triple, exists in the, quote, correct version that we got from the tree bank, even though there are mistakes in the tree bank. If the tree bank gets it wrong and we got it right, too bad, we're marked wrong, okay? Once you define that, we're now going to define two terms called precision and recall. Let C be the number of correct constituents produced by the parser over the test set, so take all the correct constituents. Let m be the total number of constituents that we guessed. Let n be the number of constituents that existed in the tree bank version. Those need not be the same. We may have guessed extra, we may have guessed too few, whatever. Precision is the percentage correct divided, is essentially the percentage we got correct divided by the how many we guessed. How, for everyone we guessed, what's the chance that it's correct? Recall is the number correct divided by the number there were to be guessed. And you can play games to try to maximize one or the other. So either you provide both, or what you do is we typically combine these in a measure called the F measure, which is simply the harmonic mean of those two numbers, which is roughly speaking the geometric average, but not quite. Okay? And so in what I'm going to produce, I'm going to be just always giving you F measures of those two numbers. Typically, for most good parsers, those two numbers are approximately the same. So the F measure and the average are very close. So how well do you do if you do just what I said? The answer is, well, better than chance, but not great. So roughly speaking, you ask, what's the precision recall F measure? And if you take a very simple probabilistic context-free grammar, the answer is you get 3 out of 4 right. Considering that your average sentence has about 18 such constituents, obviously you're not going to get, you know, you're going to make making a lot of mistakes. And you can tune it in some trivial ways, which I won't talk about, bring it up to about 78%. Not terribly good, or at least by current standards, it's not terribly good. At 1990, you would have been very pleased to get this. Probably couldn't, but these days this is just terrible. So, how do you improve it? The answer is you do what's called lexicalization. So, suppose I say, in the fashion I was talking about before, what's the probability that a verb phrase is going to expand to a verb phrase followed by two noun phrases? And I do what I just said. I look at this, how many times we see this local tree. I divide by the total number of verb phrases. The answer is about 1 out of 1,000. 1 or 2 out of 1,000, not very often. Now conversely, suppose I give you one other piece of information, namely, what was the main verb of the sentence? Or what, in particular, what is this verb? Suppose I know that the verb is set. Now I ask you, what's the conditional probability that you're going to expand this way, given that it's a verb phrase and it's said? And the answer is now, it goes down by 2 orders of magnitude. In point of fact, this is never seen for said in the entire tree bank. But of course, we don't allow zeros, because zeros kill you and never got to smooth all your numbers or else you die. So my parser assigns this about 1 out of 10,000, 100,000? I lose the ability to think when I get too close to a blackboard. So the answer is my parser says very, very low. And that's because said almost never takes this construction. Conversely, suppose it's gave. Well, we all know that give and verb like it do take that construction. Fred gave the dog a bone, etc. And so if it's gave and we ask now, the answer is it goes up by a factor of 10. Now it's about 2%. That's a huge difference. And the point is that if for some reason you find it hard to distinguish between a two-noun phrase and a one-noun phrase. Remember that first sentence at the beginning, where the salesman sold the dog biscuits? In that case, it's not obvious how many noun phrases you've got there. Well, this says if it's gave, you should be much more likely to interpret it as two-noun phrases than if it's some other verb. And so probabilities like this, which are conditioned on the main verb, very strongly help you to parse because they really sharpen the probability distributions. Also, you can start asking, well, what's the probability of the various head words given other head words? So for example, what's the probability of prices given that you're looking for a plural noun? Amazingly, it's 1.3%, which tells you that the Wall Street Journal is not exactly your everyday corpus. Okay? If I tell you that it's both a plural noun and the head of a noun phrase, it remains the same. If I tell you that this says that the parent of the noun phrase is the entire sentence, that means this is in subject position. So prices do things in the Wall Street Journal. Okay? Prices are active things, they're subjects. If I tell you that, furthermore, the main verb is a past tense verb, it doubles again, now we're up to nearly 5%. And finally, if I tell you that verb is fell, it's a whopping 14.6%, okay? So, this, by the way, should raise some alarms. Are we overtraining on this one corpus? And we will come back to that issue.
But this is free money, right? Because it's easy to do.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, you know, learning this stuff takes all of, a minute or 2 minutes or whatever, you know. Basically, it's how fast you can read those gosh darn trees in. So, this is what a lot of us have been doing. We've been taking context-free grammars, lexicalizing them like this, and trying to create general purpose parsers, okay? And there's a large literature now on this, and it's got lots of people contributing. Okay, so you should not take any of the stuff I'm describing until I get to current research as my own. All this is, what I'm describing is pretty generic. It is my version, but, there are lots of versions that are very much like it, not significantly different. So, here's what's been happening. If you look in 1995, the first of what we would call the modern parsers was produced. It had about 84% precision recall. By 1999, we were up to nearly 90%. Okay. happens after that? This only goes up to the year 01, but nothing much happens after 1999. And in fact, up until 2005, last year, that essentially was flat. The best you can, by the way, a lot of these parsers are available online. You want to get my parser, just go to my website. And, you know, of all the parsers you can get on just off the web, i.e. parsers that can really be used, this number has not gone up until this last year. And what I'm going to be talking about is why is how suddenly this number has gone up quite a bit. That's going to be the rest of this talk. Okay? So, now we are up to the beginning of this year, and what was the first thing that happened? Well, first thing that happened was a technique that's been used by several of us, most notably Michael Collins and Mark and myself, is discriminative re-ranking. So currently, we take our parser. The parser, by the way, is generative, if you want to keep this straight. And we produce a single best parse, output it, and say, that's my guess. And you know, you get about, not quite, get about 89.5 for the best of the parsers. If you wanted to, you can pull out not just the best parse, but say the top 50 parses. But of course, you still won't know which is the right one, but in fact, if you do that, you get a lot, lots of good stuff, or number 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Suppose you have some way of taking this NBEST and applying a better discriminator between them. And the reason why you might want to do that is because there are lots of techniques that are impossible at this level using a generative model, but are very easy to do at this level with a discriminative model. And I'll be going into this, I'll be giving you some examples later on. Okay? So what you do is, but this unfortunately cannot, has to take some small number of possible parsers. So we use the first stage now just to pull out some number like 50 of them. We use this stage, which can take much finer granular features, apply that to this, and then pull out what we now think is the best parser. Well, if we give ourselves not just one parse, but 50 parses, how well can we do? And the answer is, if we knew which the right one was, we could do tremendously well. So when I say oracle here, what I mean is you've got an oracle which tells you which one to pick, i.e. which is the best, and instead of getting 89.6 or 89.7, we now go up to 96.8. By the way, that is essentially human level performance now. We think, we don't have good numbers, no one actually unfortunately did the measure of what human level performance is. But my guess is, and most of our guess is, that about 97 is human level performance. So what is human level performance is going to start to become an issue, but for the moment it isn't. So if we could pick out the oracle best, we would be in really good shape. But of course, we can't do that. What we do is we apply this so-called maximum entropy re-ranker. And I'm not going to go into all the math. Many of you know the math much better than me. And I don't think I could, if you don't know it, there's no way I could explain it in the time I've got available to me. But the basic idea is you start out with your NBEST parses. You now have so-called features, and I'll be coming back to what these features might look like, but they're basically things like saying, well, if the subject is this, what, and the object is this, I like that combination. I'm going to fire, and I have a weight associated with me that says, I like this parse. Okay, and they can be very complicated features. Okay, so you've got all these features, and now you've got weights that assign to each one of these features, saying, if this feature fires, and say has a count of 1, meaning this particular combination of structure and words appeared once, and this is positive, that's going to make this parse look better. If that weight is negative, that's going to make this parse look worse. So it's a standard feature vector. And as I just explained, the value of a parse is just then the inner product of the future weight, the future values and the future weight, and that gives me a value. And then I just pick the parse y, which maximizes that value. Okay. All the complexity, of course, comes into finding these things. Once you have these things, the rest is trivial. So what do these features look like? We have basically various schema.
You said all the complexity. You meant in, say, the estimation, because choosing the features is a...
Oh, yes. Choosing the features...
is complex conceptually.
Yes.
Okay.
Although there's a lot of hunt and peck, you know. You just sort of have an idea, try it out, see what happens.
Okay.
But, you know, all the math, as it were, what goes into finding the weights. So,
but one could conceivably put math into finding the features.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
You know, the standard thing is doing some sort of search over possible features, and it's got an absolutely abysmal record.
Yeah, great idea.
Yeah.
Didn't work. Okay.
But maybe someone else has a different take on that. But certainly, that's been our experience. And I can go into why that might be true, but at any rate, it seems to be, for us, that's the case. So here's a possible feature schema. Schema says, how many constituents of length k, where k is some number like 8, crossed by whether the constituent is at the end of the sentence, before a punctuation mark, or neither? Why do you care about that? The answer is, English is a so-called right-branching language. Right-branching means that if you look at your typical tree structure, it goes like this, branches goes like this, branches goes like this. Okay, so all the constituents pretty much end at the end of the sentence. Well, this captures that idea. This is going to, essentially, it's going to notice is that it likes parses who has long constituents ending at the end of the sentence. It's going to say, I hate parses that have long constituents ending just, say, one before the end of the sentence. Maybe if it ends just before a comma, maybe I like it a bit more. But whatever it is, and of course we know what it's going to be for English, this is going to start capturing those regularities. Notice a context-free grammar does not capture that. It doesn't care where this constituent appears, it's context-free. So, this is going to capture regularities that are very difficult to put into your original context-free grammar. In particular, you can't put any of this stuff because, well, yeah. Maybe you could, but it would be extraordinarily difficult. It would bend things so far out of shape, everything else, it would make things worse, I'm sure. So that's the basic idea. So we try all possible features, and there are zillions of them. And we only allow features that fire five or more times. Anything that doesn't fire at least five times, we throw out. Even so, we end
five
up with...
Five or more times in what? In the training data?
In the training data.
Yeah. Not only in the correct answers, but in the 50 best.
That's right.
Training data.
And we get about a million features. Okay. For any given parse, of course, almost all of these will have value zero. So needless to say, if you do your data structures correctly, you don't actually look through anything like a million. Okay? What you actually do is you look at the parse and then figure out what features could possibly fire of this thing, and that's a very small number. Okay? And so you do that. One other thing I should mention. Training one of these things is messy. Difficult. Here's how you do it. The problem, of course, is this. When you train one of these re-rankers, what you want it to do is say, here are the 50 best parses, here's the correct answer, please find some set of features that's going to distinguish the best of these from all the rest based on this information. You can't just train on your entire training data. Why? Because the entire training data is trained on that best answer. And it's going to find it all the time, and it's going to be completely bogus because, of course, this doesn't reflect what's really going to happen. So what you actually have to do is you have to do cross-validation on this thing. You strike your training data in two pieces. You keep, say, of the 38,000 sentences, you take 34,000, you use them for training. This is all, this is just in the training data, but now we're taking pieces of the training data and using, calling some of it training, calling some of it development, calling some of it test. This, those 2,000 test sentences that you see there, they will not be over-accurate because you're not training on them, even though they are part of the, quote, training data. And so that gives you, then, the 50 best parses for those 2,000 sentences. And you can be reasonably confident that they will, on average, sort of look like what 50 best parses should look like, because you're not training on your, because you're not testing on training. And so what you have to do then is you have to do this 20 times, or whatever, to get all the 50 best of, for your entire training set. And now you can train the re-ranker. And that, you know, this is messy. This just takes about a day. Okay, we're no longer talking about something you can train up in a few seconds, you know. But it's a day, and you only have to do it once, and then you're done forever. So how well do you do? The answer is you do very well, or much better at any rate. So before we were talking about 89.5%, now we're talking about 91.3. Now that may not seem like a heck of a lot, but that's a 17% error reduction. Okay, and given that we hadn't seen any error reduction in 5 years, you know, that's nothing to be sneezed at. Furthermore, as I said, at this point, 100% is not achievable. So the real error reduction is probably significantly more. Okay, so that's what happened as of this last June. Okay, so that's the median term result. Now let's talk about what's really new, and this is the stuff that all the Kanashenti haven't heard yet. How do you, can you do better? Well, one thing you would love to do is learn from unlabeled data. We've only got this 1 million words of label data, i.e. where all the labels set down. Can you learn anything? You know, but we've got zillions of words of English. Can we just somehow use that those words to do better? Okay. Well, one very simple technique that you might think of is the following. It's called self-training. And what we do is we take all these extra sentences, we parse them using the system, and then pretend that the data is correct. So we feed that in as training data to our system. Okay. So before, this was the paradigm, you know, we had the training portion of the tree bank, we fed that in, collected statistics, parsed according to that, tested according to the testing portion. Okay, that's the basic paradigm. Now, what we're going to do is this. We're going to take in some unlabeled text and feed it into the parser. The parser is going to produce some results. Okay, there are our parser-produced parses. And now we're going to just feed that back into the statistics collector. So the parser says, I thought the best parse for this sentence was as follows. Of course, now we're talking about both the parser and the re-ranker. And just feed that in, and there you go. More training data. Isn't that great? You say, yeah, but it's sort of incestuous, isn't it? And the answer is, it's known not to work. So, for example, here's a quote, and I'm not picking on Steedman. Steedman is just saying what we all believed, including myself. Nor does self-training offer a way out. Charniak, 1997, showed a very small, I can add, improvement, talking about 1%, from training on 40 million words of its own output, probably because the increased size of the training set gave somewhat better counts for head dependency models. that's the model that says what's the probability of this word given the head is that word, the probability of prices given fell. However, training on data merely confirms the parser's existing view, confirms the parser's existing view, cannot help in any other way, and one might expect such improvements to be transient and eventually to degrade in the face of otherwise noisy data. And this is perfectly reasonable. Everyone believed it, including me. Okay? However, suppose for the sake of argument, Eugene Charniak has amnesia, and he forgets this well-known fact, and tries to do it anyway. You might ask at the end of the talk, what happened here? Did I really have amnesia? Well, how might you actually test to see if this is true? Okay. Well, what we did was we parsed and rewrote 40 million words of North American news text.
40 or 400? Oh, that's right. On the slide it says
400.
In 1997 you did 40.
We only use a small fraction of it. We had these grandiose ideas that maybe something would happen at 400 million words that didn't happen at 40 million. So we parsed a huge amount, okay, just to have it available. And we're going to be sending it to the LDC fairly soon.
Thank you.
And everyone will have this stuff. And we'll have the 50 best of, for all of them. Really, you know, just beautiful stuff. And my poor graduate students sweated a lot to produce it. We found all sorts of bugs. So we took 20 million words from the Los Angeles Times, and we added it to our training data, which was from the Penn Tree Bank. And we then parsed section 23 of the Penn Tree Bank, which is the traditional test portion as before. And by George, we're now up to a 25% error reduction over a year ago. And in particular, we went from 91.3 to 92.1 just by adding this extra data. So you say, what the heck is going on? Given that everyone, Michael Collins, myself, Jason Eisner knows that this won't work.
Oh, I always thought it ought to work.
Yeah.
Okay. I always thought you had a bug.
Okay.
Isn't it a biased variance deal? I mean, this will improve the variance part of the estimation error. It won't improve the bias part, but you can improve performance by reducing the variance.
All I know is it's never worked before. People have tried this many, many times. It has never worked. That quote was not on the basis of no evidence, okay? This time, it worked. What's going on? We don't know.
Chance.
That ain't statistical error, let me tell you.
It's significant.
Oh, it's hugely significant. Statistical significance is about 0.2%. I don't personally trust anything until it's 0.4%. You know, I wouldn't publish a result that's less than 0.4%. This is 0.8%. So,
because you said people have tried this.
Yeah, you do
many
enough
times.
Tests.
If you try it enough, might come up with
right.
You will.
However, there is one thing that indicates that it is not merely chance, and that is when we do the experiment, but we leave out the re-ranker. It still doesn't work. There is something about the re-ranking that makes a huge difference, and we're not quite sure what's going on.
Is one of the morals the fact that you're using something like the Los Angeles Times, maybe not in English, but that part was a joke, but the other part was
We don't know. In theory, we've got all sorts of experiments yet to conduct, okay?
So what I'm thinking of is the people who recognize both Brooklyn accent and Valley Girl have an easier time. I guess they have an easy time being a stupid UCLA. Is that what's going on?
No. According to your model, that would say if you understand Brooklyn and Valley Girl, you'll now understand Brooklyn better.
No.
That's what this is equivalent to saying. true, but, you know, it's not obvious that that's, I mean, the analogy is very loose there. But at any rate, let me continue on, okay? We can have plenty of time to, I'd like to finish a bit early so we can have time to discuss these things at the end. So anyway, so it worked, gave a huge improvement by our standards. What else can we say? Well, remember at the beginning, we said we noticed how some of our statistics were obviously very biased to the Wall Street Journal. You might ask, well, how well do these parsers do if you don't give it the Wall Street Journal, you give it something else? The answer is, for my parser, at least, very badly. But for everyone's parser, it's pretty much the same. My parser is probably slightly worse than other people's than this. And if you take the so-called Brown corpus, the Brown corpus is also parsed, hand-parsed, also by people at Penn, but it's called the Brown corpus because the original words were collected by Francis and Kutra at Brown. It's another million words of text from 1961, and it tries to be a balanced corpus. So it is not just all from one source. It includes novels, religious tracts, editorials, newspaper articles. There's actually a bit of porn in there. You know, some of the sentences you cannot read in class at Brown anymore. Tenure would be revoked. And so the question is, are the parsers sort of like overbred racehorses that are finely tuned to the Wall Street Journal and not very good on anything else? And certainly that reduction from 90% to 83.9% might suggest the answer is yes. Well, actually, let me go back before I go into the results. There was one thing here that was encouraging, and that was that when we retrained this, we didn't even retrain it on more Wall Street Journal. We retrained it on LA Times. And we said, well, wouldn't you do even better? And the answer is maybe we would, but we deliberately chose the LA Times because we didn't want to get into any possible confusion that sometimes sentences are repeated. These corpora are not, a lot of times you actually get files that are repeated in two different places, and so we wanted to make sure that we didn't have anything that possibly confound the experiment. So I picked the LA Times, which we figured would be completely distinct. If the LA Times improves it, maybe others were learning something more general, you know? And so we tried the Brown corpus, and sure enough, we get a very big improvement, okay? If we just take the basic, so this was our original, the number we started out with as of 5 years ago, okay? If we take that parser and just try it on Brown, we get the figure I cited. If we just take the re-ranking parser, we get a small improvement. And if we add the million words, or 40 million words, we get another small but medium-sized improvement. And the total error reduction, again, is 24%. Sort of like what we got before, except now we're starting from a much lower position, so of course the actual percentage is much larger. So we're no longer talking about something that fails abysmally on other corpora. Now, on this balanced corpora, we're doing pretty well. You know, sort of like what we were doing on Wall Street Journal 7 years ago. So this seems to not only do better on Wall Street Journal, but it's somehow doing better on lots of stuff. And again, we're not quite sure why.
And there is no, you didn't throw in any Brown in the retraining.
There is no Brown, no nothing. And by the way, those numbers for Brown now are about the best I've seen, even when you throw Brown in for example, Deb. I've seen some numbers where people use Brown as the dev set and get a few parameters out, and these are better than them.
Now, you haven't tried using Brown as additional training?
No, we haven't. That's something we should do and see what happens. But, you know, we're talking about results here that came out basically just before Christmas, mm-hmm. And everyone went home, and only, gotcha. And now we're just getting back, and the graduate students getting back to work. That's on our agenda.
So could it have to do with lexical generalization?
You would certainly think so, wouldn't you? So, let me just finish the talk.
Sorry.
And then I will come, no, that's a very good question. I'll come back to that. It's a very interesting question. Future work. Obviously, more experiments on self-training. You know, so for example, if I parsed a biology textbook and then fed that in as training data, would that help me parse medical stuff? Before I would have said, no way. Okay, now I'm not so sure. Now I think it's an experiment that probably is worth trying. Also, in a very different vein, and this would be a completely different lecture, I've got some very strange ideas on parsing the same sentence over and over again with different grammars. Okay. And we have a paper submitted to the North American ACL this year on a very tame version of this idea. It's a completely other talk. But I'd be happy to, like everyone else, I'd be happy to expand. So those are some ideas we intend to carry forward, and parsing has suddenly become very interesting again. It just, nothing changed for 5 years, and suddenly, all these things are changing. We're not quite sure why, but it's become a very sort of, at least to me, I stopped working on parsing for about 5 years because I couldn't think of any way to improve things, and suddenly everything seems to be working. Thank you.